quick note before we begin, this episode was recorded earlier in 2020 in the studio, before you know what happened. All right, let's begin.
When we choose which startups to invest capital in, fundamentally, if a CEO and a founder doesn't appreciate the potential need to deal with regulation, then my view is that's not the kind of person I want to invest in the first place.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Goldman, and this is Future Proof. So today we are very lucky because we were able to finagle Bradley Tusk to come back into the studio. If you haven't heard our previous episode with him, definitely go take a look in our archive. Just to kind of recap, he is a venture capitalist, political strategist. He's the founder and CEO of Tusk Holdings, which includes a number of different companies. But I really wanted to talk to him today about some of the amazing work that he's done working with startups and helping save them basically from politics and regulation, helping them figure out how to work within the rules and regulations and even push the envelope sometimes. Previously, Bradley served as campaign manager for Mike Bloomberg, deputy governor of Illinois, and as communications director for Chuck Schumer, and then, perfect transition, as Uber's first political strategist. So, Bradley, welcome back to Future Proof.
Yeah, thanks for having me on again.
Yeah, no, this is great. I thought it was really interesting. I know that you wrote in your book that Uber wasn't always inevitable.
Right.
And it seems like regulation is this critical problem to solve for before you can make any disruptive technology inevitable. Right?
Yeah,
Do you agree?
Since I've founded a venture capital firm around that,
it'd be a problem otherwise.
It'd be a problem if I did. My LPs would be like, what the fuck? Here's the thing. If you create a disruptive startup, which sounds super cool to you or me or listen to something called Future Proof, that means that you're disrupting somebody. There's an entrenched interest there, and they don't want to lose their livelihood. They don't want to lose their market share. So they're like, oh, you're right. This is a better way to book a hotel room or get a car or whatever it is. Go right ahead. They try to defend themselves. And since they often can't defend themselves on having a better product or a better service or anything like that, they resort to politics and regulation, and they use campaign contributions and lobbyists and things like that to try to shut down new ideas and new types of innovations. And if you're doing something that's truly disruptive, you have to anticipate where that's going to come from. You have to be ready for it. And if you're not, you know, I have a chapter in my book called Strangle the Baby in the Crib. If I were an entrenched interest, that's what you got to try to do, because if you let a startup get ahead of steam, then all of a sudden they can gain a lot of momentum and win.
Well, and yeah, I mean, I think in some ways what's interesting to me is that you've got all these regulators now, and not just now, but all the time, you know, that they see these new ideas that, and they look at these ideas and say, like, you need to conform to our rules, even if that means it's going to nullify all the benefits of that new idea in the first place.
Look, that's backwards thinking, but I think a lot of times, and I've worked in government enough to sadly know this firsthand, people in government forget that they're there to serve the public, and they see it the opposite, which is the public is there to serve them. And the mentality is, you know, I'll decide what's right or wrong and won't conform to it. But by definition, if you have a product that's getting lots of traction in the marketplace, that means that your constituents want to use it, right? So, like, if we take scooters, we're investors in a scooter company called Bird.
Bird is huge.
Yeah. So we've been in it since Series A, and we've worked a lot on how to legalize electric scooters. And one of the biggest proof points we had with regulators is, look, clearly people want to use this thing because we're growing in your city like crazy. So you could say, no, you just can't use it. Then we can have a big, ugly fight, and we can embarrass you and win. Or you can accept the fact that this is here, and let's figure out the right, sensible way to regulate this product. And that's true whether it's scooters or new types of insurance or cryptocurrency or esports or whatever.
I mean, I think it's definitely fascinating when you look at all these different regulators that, you know, they might even necessarily, they might work within a progressive state, but I think bureaucracy is maybe inherently conservative in the sense that let's not let anything,
for sure,
you know, get broken, but let's not, and to some extent, you might almost make the argument that the legal profession is like that. It's trying to protect rather than looking for opportunity.
It's much harder to get in trouble for saying no to something than for saying yes and having it fail.
So this is something that I think you know a lot about, and obviously financially there's an incentive for you to explain why this is something that's important for people to understand. But why is it important, you know, for a startup to understand each state's regulatory environment when they're trying to shape the future?
Because we live in a federalist society, which means that most of the rules set out in this country happen from cities and states, not from the U.S. government. If you have a product that's only governed by the federal government, regulated by them, then that's what you have to worry about. But that's true of almost nobody. By and large, you've got to deal with 50 different states and hundreds of different cities. And, you know, yes, you can say, okay, I'll only care about California, New York, Texas, whatever the big ones are. But the politics in all those states are different, right? Some are very liberal, some are very conservative. And at the end of the day, to build a really big business, you have to be in operation pretty much everywhere, which means that you have to deal with 50 different regulatory schemes, working on 50 different sets of statutes, and 50 different sets of political interests, right? In some of the places where you are operating, the people you're disrupting will be very politically powerful, and you've got a big fight ahead. And other places, they won't be particularly powerful, and you can steamroll them. But you've got to understand the context of what you're dealing with on the front end, or you're not going to succeed.
And to me, what's so interesting and fascinating is I like to think about like all of the different things that impact the future and help shape it that nobody ever thinks about because they're not sexy. So, for instance, regulations and rules, it's, you know.
You don't find regulations sexy?
Well, it's a, you know, perfect example is I've been very close to the autonomous vehicle space, you know, for years.
Sure.
And the technology has been ahead of the regulations, for ever. And and this is a thing that I think people don't think about. The average person is like, the technology isn't there. It's not ready yet. I'm like, nah, actually, it is ready.
At least for level four.
Yeah. You know, like there are a lot of people who have invested their time and effort to solve for a technological problem, but they don't often think about, okay, and who are the entrenched interests that they have to find a way to challenge and overcome?
Yeah, I mean, look, regulation almost always lags innovation. And one of the reasons why, if it takes a little while to get AVs on the road, it's going to be because the right regulatory framework wasn't created in cities or states. And this is one of those issues where Washington really ought to step in and preempt the cities and states. It's a little crazy to say that we're going to have 50 different sets of rules for autonomous vehicles when you cross state lines, all of a sudden your hands have to go on the wheel or off the wheel or whatever it is. So Washington should act on this, but should act and will act are obviously two different things. They haven't really done that yet. We're investors in an autonomous trucking startup called Kodiak, based in Menlo Park. And, you know, we've actually had to work with states like California and Texas to create opportunities to both test the technology and then go into operation itself because the federal government just really can't get its act together.
Do you know, side note, by the way, total aside, do you know Mobileye?
Yeah, for sure.
Oh, okay.
When I was, as we discussed off the air, I have a podcast as well called Firewall. If you like it, check it out. And I did a series last May in Tel Aviv. And I interviewed 8 different startups, and one of them was the VP of Mobileye.
Oh, okay, cool. Yeah, I did the branding for them back in 2003, and I was shocked
that they actually... I hope you took equity.
I did not. I will be honest about that. But I made people who I know a decent amount of the cash,
sure,
so
did.
I'll be okay with that. But it's just actually funny that given how B2B something like autonomous vehicles and technology is, that they never really re-explored the logo and the branding. So it was kind of nice to all of a sudden see something that I had put together on the side of the stock exchange.
Yeah,
I'll take it.
Super cool. So Mobileye at least said that they're going to have autonomous taxis on the streets of Tel Aviv by next year, 2021. I'm not sure if that's feasible or not. The Israeli regulators aren't necessarily any more innovative or better than the U.S. regulators on this stuff. But it would be super cool if they did.
Well, and it's interesting, actually, because, I mean, of course there are, and I think you even talk about this in your book, there are certain advantages in certain places where we actually need regulation. So it's not that regulation is inherently evil, because I'm sure you can think about a few international markets where they don't have enough regulation.
Yeah, or just take cryptocurrency, right? On one hand, I think that there's a very valid argument that people feel like they don't trust central institutions like federal banks, and they prefer to deal with like-minded people in a digital way. That's fine. I believe in cryptocurrency too, but there's also a tremendous amount of fraud in the crypto space, and you want the regulators, you want the SEC, you want the Department of Justice going after scams, you want them going after bullshit ICOs. So, you know, it's not that you don't want regulation, you just want regulation that actually makes sense and doesn't hamstring the technology and cripple growth.
Yeah, and I think also, and I know we talked about this the last time you were on, there's a certain element of people paying a little bit more attention to the negativity of any new disruptive technology. Right. So, for instance, let's just say if there's a new disruptive technology and autonomous vehicles are on the road and there's a fatality, that will get covered more than a quote-unquote traditional fatality.
Look, and someone getting killed in a car accident every day, it doesn't even make the paper or make the news. If a Tesla driving on its own runs over someone, that's a front-page story.
Yeah, but in some ways, this is almost the whole human fallacy of not studying data. You know, like we actually care about a thing that's a more interesting story,
right,
as opposed to, like, I mean, if we have decreased the total number of fatalities, that's what you should care about as opposed to anything else.
And car crashes, I think, the number one cause of death, not counting like smoking or whatever. And right, if you were to have autonomous vehicles operating effectively, you would exponentially reduce the amount of deaths and injuries and accidents that you would have. But in the way to get there is that you have to have a lot of testing, and you know, like in all testing, something will occasionally go wrong. The problem is so much attention is paid to those few hiccups that it ends up threatening the ability of the entire thing to exist in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, and when you're thinking of people who you've worked with, you know, and Travis Kalanick comes to mind, right, from Uber, mm-hmm. Who are able to kind of see the future before other people around them were able to. I mean, what are some of the traits that people like that have? And then also, what separates the people who get that regulations are going to be important versus the people who are like, no, I'm smart, I'm going to figure it out?
Yeah, and Travis, I think, actually checks all those boxes. The first time I ever met him, he said to me, one day, nobody will own a car, they'll all drive themselves, and you'll get it by pressing a button. And I believe that there's no one in the world who's done more to make that a reality ever since then than Travis Kalanick. And he had a few attributes that I think really allowed him to be successful. One is he could see where the world was going in terms of car ownership, in terms of autonomous vehicle technology, in terms of the sharing economy. But at the same time, he was also very, very focused on the details, and that included regulation. So he was willing to really say, okay, here are all the things that are going to get in my way. Here's what I need to deal with. And he took politics and regulation seriously. And he had to, because at the time, we were this tiny little Series A company taking on a giant cartel in taxi, or a rough cartel in taxi. And only someone as tough and ruthless as Travis, and as relentless as Travis, and smart as Travis, was going to win that war, and he did.
But, you know, at the same time, I think that having the foresight to say that regulations and figuring out how to work within them and, you know, work within them, or even say, forget about that, let's ask for forgiveness later, you know, as I know that Uber kind of did to some extent in certain places.
Yeah, not quite as much as the press likes to say. But
right. But it's just interesting to me that there are some people who might invent something as disruptive, and then because regulation is not the sexy, interesting topic, then they say, like, we're going to figure it out, and maybe they don't invest in actually.
Airbnb is a good example of that, right? So it's a great product, it's a great technology, but in the early days of Airbnb, their attitude was like, oh yeah, we'll deal with it, or if we just keep our head down, no one will really notice. And as a result, they had the opportunity to really legalize themselves, for example, here in New York, and they didn't take it because they were too passive. And then in being passive, they gave their opposition, the hotel unions, the hotels themselves, the affordable housing advocates, enough time to catch their breath and come up with a strategy. And now Airbnb is effectively illegal in New York. And so by being so passive and not taking regulation seriously, they locked themselves out of one of the most lucrative markets in the world. So, you know, you see that all the time. And look, when we choose which startups to invest capital in, fundamentally, if a CEO and a founder doesn't appreciate the potential need to deal with regulation, then my view is that's not the kind of person I want to invest in the first place.
So, yeah, and when you're thinking also about, like, being able to shape the future, I think one of the things that you talked about a little bit with Uber is going directly to constituents, right? Mm-hmm. And actually people who have power, individual users of an app, right? They can raise their hand and they can say, I want a certain thing to happen. And that's, I feel like, been a very transformative, disruptive thing over the last few years. But do you expect it to stay that way for the foreseeable future? Like, basically, do you think that the individual is going to be able to have a groundswell effect and change?
I think it'll come and go in waves, to be honest. Sometimes there are technologies that people just really want to have access to, and they're willing to do what it takes to try to get it. But there are also moments where tech is more popular than other times. So right now, I think we're in the midst of a tech lash, where you have, you know, bad behavior by Facebook, questionable behavior by Amazon, by Google, all leading to a tremendous outcry, both in city, state, and federal government, and by the way, all over the world, the EU especially, and people don't trust Facebook. And as a result, right now, when those companies are riding high and doing really well, it has a halo effect for all of tech up and down the stack. And when they're in trouble, and right now I think Facebook is being investigated by 46 different state attorney generals. And,
that's all?
Yeah.
One or two extra states just so more than 50 can investigate them.
The Virgin Islands all of a sudden is investigating Facebook. And then, you know, the federal government and, you know, it's a mess over there. So in some ways, you know, the ability of tech to take on entrenched interests, you know, depends on how some of the giants are doing. And part of the thing is that, you know, we use tech as a very broad term. But in reality, every company is a tech company. You and I are sitting at a wood table. But whoever made this table used technology to design it, construct it, market it, ship it, all these different pieces. So there's no such thing as a business that doesn't rely on technology one way or another. We almost need to come up with a better term for it because, you know, these super early stage startups that I invest in sometimes have nothing in common with Facebook or Amazon or Apple, these trillion-dollar companies.
Well, that's why WeWork was an interesting case of a company that, you know, found a really great opportunity to kind of get that tech valuation.
Yep.
But inherently, you know, you look at it, of course there was some technology, but
It's a real estate company.
Yeah, it's a real estate company that had a really great pitch, I think. So.
Yeah, look, Adam Neumann, and I don't know Adam, but from everyone I know who does, not known as the nicest guy out there, so I don't feel any particular need to defend him. But, you know, for everyone on this who listened to this podcast who's been in a WeWork, he created something pretty cool, right? And he managed to take, you know, the way that we work and create an alternative vision for it, an alternative version of it, and get people really excited about it and to use it all over the world. So, like, it's not that he didn't accomplish something meaningful. I think he did. But just because you do something cool or meaningful doesn't mean it's a $50 billion company, right? There are things that can be good ideas or good innovations or good for society, but have, you know, economic benefit, but not unlimited economic benefit. And I think valuations for companies like WeWork and Uber and others got a little out of control. And investors who came in really late lost money.
Yeah, and it seems like a lot of the companies that are succeeding these days, and I'm doing a series of talks on kind of predicting the future, the successful startup of tomorrow, and what are the things that are most correlated with success, and what are the things that don't actually matter as much as one might think. And I think one of the things that's really interesting to me is just to look to see, like, one thing that tends to attract a lot of funding these days, and you know this, is narrow casting, you know, finding a niche and saying, listen, we're not going to be a $50 billion company, but we found a very lucrative niche and we are going to dominate that one particular niche.
I mean, if you can capture 50% of a total addressable market of $5 billion, you know, that's just as good as capturing 10% of a TAM of $25 billion.
So I want to ask you, just pivoting off of that a little bit, you know, you spent a good part of your early career finding opportunities for politicians to get in front of microphones.
Yeah.
So how important is getting in front of the proper microphones critical for shaping the future in general?
It's the same thing, right? Which is, you know, there's so much information flying at us all the time that we're absorbing things very quickly, processing it mainly in our subconscious, and then making determinations one way or another. And, you know, either you're the one shaping what's said about you, what's written about you, what's out there about you, or someone's doing it to you, right? And in every case, it's hard to not argue for being proactive. There may be certain situations where you want to try to keep things quiet because you're developing something new or whatever it is. But even then, even if you're not out there talking about it, you should know what the strategy is. You should know what the narrative is. You should be ready to go out there and talk about it as soon as either you're ready to or the story breaks anyway. And I think people who, you know, don't think about that or feel like they're above that, it's the same thing that happens. People don't think about regulation, which is, you know, the story gets told, and either you're telling it or someone else is telling it. If someone else is telling it, odds are I'm not telling it exactly the way you'd like to.
And I like that the way that Uber, and I don't know if this is a thing you had a hand in or at least you're familiar with, I'm sure you are, of course, the confrontational aspect, and I mean that in a positive way, the fact that, listen, if you have this really great mailing list, if you have this really great app that people are always in, why not take advantage of it to rally them to your side?
Yeah, and I think sometimes, look, you know, regulators, politicians in general, If we assume, we talked about this the last time that we were together, if we assume that politicians are always going to make a rational choice to advance their political interest, if you're a politician and the taxi industry gives out nice campaign contributions, and they say, hey, can you do this for me? If there's no political cost to you for doing it, you're going to do it because you want the money, right? But all of a sudden, 20,000 of your constituents are emailing you and tweeting at you and texting you and saying, leave this thing alone, I care about it, you're going to back off. And in some ways with Uber, we had to create a certain amount of fear for politicians to say, shit, I'm not going to mess with this. Sorry, taxi industry, not this one. And that requires creating a certain narrative and a certain perception.
Yeah, and I think that also what's interesting to me about that is that sometimes people that we've kind of talked about this already is, you know, like sometimes innovation means you're taking two steps forward and one step back, right? Which is the way that I think about it. Like the devil's advocate argument for me that I don't necessarily believe is the whole taxi drivers hurt by Uber or, you know, all of the other disadvantages associated with things like this. Like no innovation's ever going to be perfect. And I think that people just focus too much on the negative.
No, and I think ultimately, you know, if an industry doesn't evolve, doesn't improve, and taxi's a really good example because, you know, anyone who's been in the back of a yellow cab, and by the way, this isn't just true in New York, it's true anywhere in the U.S. or really the world. If the drivers are unfriendly and the cabs are dirty and smelly and the price is high, and you never make any attempt to improve it because you have a monopoly, then when someone breaks that monopoly, you're really going to suffer. And while you don't want to see individual taxi drivers suffer, the people that own the medallions, at least, who are now asking for bailouts from cities, some of them purchased them as high as a price of $1.2, $1.3 million. Now the valuation's, you know, under $100,000 in a lot of places. They weren't really good actors most of the time. I mean, they chose to try to really exploit a system and exploit a monopoly, and they were lazy and they were greedy, and eventually they paid the price for it.
And, I mean, that's the thing. I think people forget, you know, that you could very easily be like a minority of a different color than you or I in an outer borough, and good luck trying to get a cab, you know. And
yeah,
this was a...
one of the very first things I did for Uber, and this was back early in 2011, was I wrote an ad for Black Radio that said, when you ask for an Uber, no one knows the color of your finger. Because fundamentally, you know, most African-Americans, Latinos, and most cities around the U.S. all have stories of seeing an empty cab go right by, their hands up, and they just don't pick them up. And for whatever Uber's been accused of the years, no, I've never heard anyone talk about racial discrimination. They call it, you call it, someone takes the job, they come and take you.
Yeah, no, I love that. I mean, just want to, I know you got to let you go in a minute or two. In your book, you write that if you can control the flow of attention, you can get people to do things or not do things that can have a major impact, right? So why is that such an important lesson for those startups and companies trying to navigate rules and regulations?
Yeah, because at the end of the day, most people who run for office do so because they're really, really desperate for attention, right? They have to have that. It's like oxygen for you and me. I think I said this on the last podcast too. And they're either the ones directly setting the rules or they appoint the regulators who set the rules. So either way, they're the ones who really have the power in this equation. And if they're mainly thinking about the next election, right? So if they think, hey, if I work with these guys, I got a better chance of winning. Or if I don't do what they want, I have a greater chance of losing. Then they're going to work with you. And if they think that either you can't impact the next election or nobody cares what you say, they're going to ignore you and do whatever they want to do. And so if you want to get their support and you want to get their validation and everything else, you've got to be able to make them feel like you can really be determinative in their next election. And the thing they care about the most is attention. And so if you get them good press, they tend to do what you want. If you get them bad press, they tend to do what you want. And if you have no impact on the press, they tend to ignore you.
I love that. And since we didn't last time or this time really do our traditional lightning round, I want to give you, at the very least, one quick lightning round question.
About the Mets, or that's mainly what I've been thinking about the last few days, but yeah.
Oh, really? Well, that's like a whole nother episode.
Podcast,
yeah,
right.
Yeah. No, but I wanted to ask you, most challenging boss to work for, Chuck Schumer, Mike Bloomberg, or Rod Blagojevich?
Rod Blagojevich. So Mike's actually not a hard boss as long as you have your shit together, right? As long as you know what you're doing and work really hard and you're prepared, he gives you an incredible amount of autonomy and freedom. Chuck was a really hard boss because Chuck cared about getting press attention more than anyone I've ever met, and I was in charge of his press. And so I would have to talk to him 24/7 to kind of help him scratch the itch for attention and validation. But still, Chuck is an honest, hardworking, decent guy. Rod's a criminal, right? And the thing with Rod is, had Rod pled insanity, I believe they would have had to have given it to him. You know, the problem is crazy people don't think they're crazy, so he didn't ask for insanity. But he was really disturbed in some ways, and I had the weird combination of, in some ways, he wouldn't come to work at all. He'd go 3 or 4 months without coming to the office because he saw the job of running for office and the job of holding office as two totally different jobs and thought his job was only the job of running for office.
How nice was his house? I just got to say, I got to get out of the house.
Pretty nice, you know. But he was like was an agoraphobe, whatever it is where you don't like to leave the house. Yeah. And so on one hand, you kind of had to run the government on your own because he wasn't there to help you do it. On the other hand, he was a real conspiracy theorist and really paranoid. And so he'd spend all day calling me up saying, this one's out to get me, that one's out to get me. And while a lot of his theories were crazy, because it was Chicago politics, they were out to get him. Everyone's always out to get everyone in Chicago politics. Yeah. So, you know, I just had him acting like a nut so much of the time. And then I'm trying to run as deputy governor. I was responsible for the state's budget operations, legislation, policy, communications. So I'm 29 years old, and I'm trying to run the fifth biggest state in the country. It's a pretty demanding job. And then I've got this lunatic on my back 24/7. So I would say of the various bosses I've had, and you could throw Travis in that mix also, Rod is the worst.
Wow. And I got to just say, note to self, if you're an agoraphobe, you know, try to do things that'll keep you out of prison, right?
Yeah. Or at least don't run for office.
Yeah, exactly. And on that great note, you know, thank you so much for coming back to us.
This was
fantastic.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
And thanks again, Bradley, for joining us for a second time. Once again, if you didn't hear the first part of our conversation X number of episodes ago, go look back in your feed. I really enjoyed that one. I think it was tied for as interesting as our second part of our conversation. Once again, make sure to review us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and wherever finer podcasts are sold. It really helps new people find this show week after week. And we thank all of you for your support. Once again, I'm Jeremy Goldman, and you've been listening to Future Proof.